Now, if our principle of interpreting the book of Revelation is correct, then Revelation is a book of the Bible which consists of seven visions. And each of these visions is divided into seven parts. And so you have seven times seven parts to the book of Revelation. The first vision consists of Christ amongst the golden candlesticks. That is to say, Jesus Christ, the judge of the church, comes down to examine what men have done with his church in history. And this first vision of the seven letters to the seven churches is a vision that spans the whole period of church history. From the coming of Christ, the day of Pentecost, until the second coming of Christ, and I am assuming that when Christ comes the second time, there is nothing beyond that other than heaven and hell. After all, when eternity invades time, there is no more time. C.S. Lewis puts it like this way: when the author walks onto the stage, the play is finished. Now, Jesus Christ is the author of history. What's going on just now is the drama of history, and we are all playing our part. And the Christian churches are all playing their part in this great drama on the stage of history. But one day the author of this drama will come onto the stage. And when he walks on, that's the end of the play. There's nothing beyond that other than heaven and hell. And so in this first vision, seven letters to seven churches, we have the whole epoch of church history from the coming of Christ and the day of Pentecost, the birthday of the church, if you'd like to call it that, until the second and the last coming of Christ. Now, last week, I tried to see a pattern at work in these seven letters. And the pattern seems to be this: that the first church and the seventh church, first and the last, are in the greatest danger. Because the first one, Ephesus, had lost its first love, and the marriage had grown cold, the temperature had dropped, and even, within 60 years of the death of Jesus Christ, you had a church that was beginning to grow cold towards God. That's Ephesus. The last church is Laodicea, the church that was neither hot nor cold, because, as we'll see when we come to it, Laodicea stood at a point where two rivers met, and there were hot springs in the district. And one of the rivers was cold, and another river was warm, because it came from the spa. And where the rivers met, they became lukewarm, and that's where the town of Laodicea stood. And God said to the church there, "You know, you are my emetic. You make me sick. You're neither one thing nor the other. If you were cold and hated me, I could do something with you. If you were warm and loved me, I could do something with you. But you are neither for me nor are you against me. Therefore I will spew you out of my mouth." And so the first church and the last church are in the greatest peril. The churches that Christ commends are churches 2 and 6. That's to say, just inside the churches that are dangerous, especially the one tonight, Smyrna. You see, the name means the town where the myrrh comes from. And myrrh in the Bible is a spice that is associated with suffering and death. It's one of the spices that was used to embalm the bodies of loved ones. Did the women who tried to embalm the body of Christ not take with them myrrh and spices? And so Smyrna is the myrrh town. And the name of the town was almost prophetic of the Christian community inside it, because it was a community that was marked out for suffering and death. So Christ commends that one. And he also commends church number 6, just before the end. But in the middle, churches 3, 4, and 5, you get a kind of neutral conglomeration. As much as to say, and this is what John is saying, the church of Jesus Christ will be in her greatest peril at her birth and at the end of the age. But for the greater part of church history, the churches will be neutral and indifferent towards Jesus Christ. Now I challenge any of you to go through church history books, and I think that you'll find that in the 2,000 years of church history, the church, by and large, has not done the will of Christ. She has been a poor, poor witness for Jesus Christ. And in fact, a living Christian church is now the exception rather than the rule. Some of our Pentecostal brethren speak about continuous Pentecost. They say that the Christian church ought always to be in a state of revival. Well, I don't know if that's true, but it's a long, long, long time since we've seen any such Pentecostal sign in the Christian church. I know that there are signs today. Some people mightn't think they were authentic. Continuous revival? I tell you, that's the exception rather than the rule in the Christian church. And so churches 3, 4, and 5, John says, this is what the Christian church is going to be like in history. It's going to be a mealy-mouthed, wishy-washy, half-hearted affair, not true to Jesus Christ. And only churches 2 and 6 are commended. Now you see, the fascinating thing is this. That you now begin to see the work of Satan in the church. I wonder if you picked up the references to Satan and the devil in the passage we read this evening. It's worth looking at this. In chapter 2, verse 9, he says, I know your tribulation. Oh, that's beautiful. It means I know you're going through the mill. I know that the devil's got you under the millstone, and it's a sore, sore thing. And I know your poverty, but you are rich. And the slander of those who say that they are Jews, true Jews, and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Isn't that interesting? 60 years after the death of Jesus Christ, and here is a synagogue of Satan inside a Christian church. Next verse. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw you into prison. Some of you into prison that you may be tested for 10 days. For 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death. Look at verse 13 in the church at Pergamum. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Isn't that interesting? The growth of satanic activity in the Christian church Read on. Well, verse 13, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. You hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you. Where Satan dwells, there it is again. In the next church, the church at Thyatira, verse 24, but to the rest of you in Thyatira, who do not hold this teaching, that's the teaching of Jezebel, whom he's been speaking about, a lady in charge of the church, who do not hold this teaching, who have not learned what some call the deep things of Satan. Now do you see the progress? In the church at Ephesus, Satan was outside the church, the temple of Diana. In the church at Smyrna, there was a synagogue, which means a gathering of Satan, inside the church. In the church at Pergamum, Satan's throne was inside the church. And in the church at Thyatira, the deep things of Satan were being taught in the Christian church. Now, do you see what this is? It's a takeover bid by Satan. And you can read right through to the end of this book of Revelation, and you find that as you move towards the end of the age, more and more and more, the devil controls the church. Read it for yourselves. The beast, the false prophet, Babylon the Great, the harlot, the imitation bride of Christ. Because just as Jesus has a bride, the devil has a bride too. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, drunk with the blood of the saints. And what you really see at work in church history is a takeover bid by Satan, and it is done so subtly and so cleverly that people can't tell the difference between Satan and Christ. This is magnificent. If you see this, you've got a key to the understanding of the collapse of the Christian church in our generation. Are you not aware that in the next 10 years, 50% of the ministers of the Church of Scotland will have retired? In 10 years' time, there will be half the number of ministers in Scotland that there are tonight. And unless there's a revival, which we mustn't exclude, what's the church in Scotland going to be like in 10 years' time? Do you know that because of the new financial demands by 121 George Street upon smaller congregations, within the next 5 years, hundreds of congregations in Scotland are going to go right to the wall. They just cannot survive. They'll just close up. They'll just fold up. They cannot survive. I tell you that if you see Satan working in the church, you have one of the most tremendous keys to church history. In Ephesus, he was outside the church. In Smyrna, he had a synagogue. In Pergamum, he had a throne. In Thyatira, they were teaching Satan and calling it Christ. Oh, this is tremendous. And towards the end of the book, we'll see how brilliantly he does it. Does Christ have a spokesman? Of course he has, the Holy Ghost. Does the devil have a spokesman? Of course he has, the false prophet. Can Christ perform miracles? Of course. Can the devil perform miracles? Of course. Performs miracles towards the end of Revelation so impressive that the whole world goes after the beast. Does Jesus set a mark upon the people who belong to him? Of course he does. Does the devil put a mark on those who belong to him? Of course he does. It's the mark of the beast. Does Jesus rise from the dead? Of course he does. Does the devil rise from the dead? Of course he does. Because John says that on the dragon's head there's a mark as though it had been slain, but it grew again. Resurrection. And so he's resurrected in every generation. He becomes incarnate in every generation. And he works in the Christian church. Now are you listening to me? I have my coronary this week. Will you have learned this from me? That you need the eyes of Jesus Christ to discern the workings of Satan. I'll put it like this. There were two ladies on the vacancy committee when I came here who heard me preaching in foyers. And those two ladies are now 100% behind me in my ministry. They are in church twice a Sunday, and they are in the prayer meeting on Saturday evening without fail praying. And they're right behind my ministry and everything I stand. Do you know, when they heard me preaching at foyers, they thought I was insufferable. Now, why should two evangelical Christians find an evangelical preacher insufferable? Even if you make allowances for all the many mistakes, and they're very obvious. The voice can be irritating. The mannerisms can be irritating. The temper can be a bit fierce. The temperature can sometimes be a bit high. But even if you allow for all the mistakes and all the failings, which are very, very, very obvious, and which no one criticizes more sharply than I do, why should evangelical Christians find an evangelical preacher unendurable? Was it Jesus who did that to them? It was the devil. And if you see this, you have the key to Christian history. I'll say it again. In Ephesus, he was outside the church, the devil. In Smyrna, he had a synagogue inside the church. In the next place, he had a throne. And in the next place, they were teaching him. Oh, this is tremendous. What then was the difference between Smyrna and Pergamos? It was this. The local interest teaches us something. Smyrna was the Glasgow of the ancient world. It was the vast commercial town. And of course, its money was made with myrrh, which was very expensive. It was the myrrh city. Pergamos was Oxford. Now that was the difference. The difference between Glasgow and Oxford. Glasgow, well, that's money. Noise, crowds, commerce, industry. Oxford, culture, refinement, academics, learning of the colleges. Now the interesting thing is this. That in these two towns, God had two rivals. Because the town Smyrna worshipped the god Dionysius, whose other name was Bacchus, and he was the god of wine. And it was proverbial in the ancient world that the men of Smyrna were the biggest drunkards on earth. In Pergamos, they didn't worship drink. They worshipped medicine. Because the god of Pergamos was Aesculapius. And Aesculapius's symbol was a snake round a rod. Now that's why he's at the British Medical Association, Dr. Christensen, has the snake of Aesculapius twisting round a rod. Now I used to think that that snake of the British Medical Association was the brazen serpent of Moses, and that you look at the snake on the rod and you are healed, as people were in the wilderness. But it's not that. It's the snake of Aesculapius, the god of medicine. It's the difference between a place that is given over to drink, Smyrna, and is rather aura and common and debased and degraded, and a place that's rather refined and cultured. After all, Pergamum gave its name to Pergament, which was the old name for parchment. And only learned people had Pergament or parchment in those days. It's the difference between a Christian church in a drunken aura city and a Christian church in a rather cultured, refined place. And the thing that really made the Christians in Smyrna survive, and the ones in Pergamon didn't, was the question of conformity. Because the Christians in Smyrna didn't conform. And that's why they went through the mill. And that's why they were poor. And that's why Christ said to them, "My dear children, I know what you're going through. I know that you're under the millstone. And I know your poverty, although the place round you is rotten with money and with money and drink. I know what you're going through because you have refused to conform." But in Pergamum, you got the doctrine of Balaam. Do you know that story? The king of Moab wanted to curse God's people, and so he sent for the professional clergyman, Balaam. He said, here's some money. Get onto the hill and curse that people. And Balaam climbed the hill and he opened his mouth to curse them. And a blessing came out. So Balak was furious. He said, go up to another hill. Maybe God didn't hear you from that one. And curse this people. And he opened his mouth and a blessing came out. And Balak was furious. He said, go to another hill and get up the hill and curse that people. And he opened his mouth and a blessing came out. And he said, how can I curse the people whom God has blessed? But what Balak was trying to get God's people to do was compromise. Worship God, okay. But compromise your morals. Don't take a stand. Compromise. Fit in. Grow together. Look at it. Verse 13. Oh, I know where you dwell. Now, that can be read. I know where you have your home. I know where you are most comfortable, where Satan's throne is. It's pretty serious that, to be at home where the devil has his throne. You hold fast my name. You did not deny my faith, even the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. But you've compromised. I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, that they might eat food sacrificed to idols. Compromise. And practice immorality. Compromise. Now you see, the problem is this. It's not simply a choice of going on as a church in this world, although that's important. Smyrna went through the mill and survived. In fact, she produced some very choice fruit. In a few years' time, she produced one of the greatest Christian martyrs, Polycarp. You know the story of Polycarp? Polycarp. Carp is the Greek word for fruit. Polycarp. Much fruit. The man with much fruit. Listen to what he said as they were burning him. When invited to save his life by reviling Christ, he made this famous answer, 46 years have I been his servant, and he hath done me no wrong. How then can I blaspheme the King who saved me? That's what tribulation does for a man. So Smyrna went through the mill and survived. And Pergamum compromised and died. But the choice is deeper than that. You see, it's a question of destiny, really. It's not just simply a question of what happens to you in this world. It's a question of what happens to you in the next world. Verse 17. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. To him who conquers, I will give in the next world some of the hidden manna. That's a reference to the manna that was inside the ark. And I will give him a white stone. Now, do you know what that is? It's character. The white stone was used in voting. in ancient Greece. They didn't have ballot tickets the way we have. They were given white stones. And if you were for the candidate's character, then you threw the white stone into the ring. God says, Christ says, the judge of the church says, looking into your eyes tonight, if you overcome, I will vote for you. I'll give you a white stone. I'll be on your side. I'll give you your character. You see, that's all that happens in heaven. You just get back your character. Don't be shocked. I don't believe that very much happens on the day of judgment. It's all settled. It's all fixed. Nothing changes on the day of judgment. All that happens is that we get our characters back. And for some people that'll be heaven, and for other people that'll be hell. But you get the stone, the white stone. No doubt about that. So you see, it's not just a question of surviving or not surviving as a church down here. It's a question of destiny. I will give him a white stone with a new name. See, names and characters go together. Written on the stone, which no one knows except him who receives it. God make us worthy to that end, and may he be praised and blessed in the preaching of his word.